And now let's give a warm Tulare County welcome to our warm-up speaker, Sherry.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Sherry, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 29th, 2009. The premise for these meetings is to tell you what it was like, how I got sober, and what it's like now. And I got to try and do that in 10 minutes. I'm long-winded, so we'll see how well I do. A perfect scenario of what it was like is a friend of mine in the program, who's a sister in sobriety, told me that I do angry well. Now, me being the alcoholic that I am, I took that as a compliment. That's what it was like for me. I was a very angry person. And the one thing that has come clear to me in the program is that justifiable anger is my worst enemy. In 2000, I lost my oldest son. He passed away. I was pregnant with my youngest son at the time, who's now 15. I honestly believe that if it hadn't been for that, I gave birth to my youngest son 11 days after my oldest son passed away. And I honestly believe that if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't be standing in front of you, period. I was on a path of self-destruction, though at the time I didn't know it. And the only thing that kept me relatively sane was taking care of my youngest child. I'm a caregiver by nature. That's what I do. I like taking care of people, and I still like to take care of people. And now I do a career at it, but yeah, those people. Yeah. In the program, I was given an opportunity, a career opportunity, and I took it, and it suits my personality great. I became a correctional officer. Yeah, so I get to boss people around all day, and then laugh. And my job is very entertaining. I love it. I love it. People think I'm crazy because I love my job. I'm around criminals all day, but they're entertaining. I get paid to be entertained by the people that I supervise and by the people that I work with. And I wouldn't have that if it wasn't for this program. I wouldn't have that if it wasn't for sobriety. So needless to say, I got sober. And my last drunk, it was a binge rage, you know. My clearest thought was pulling out all the fuses in my toy hauler so my husband couldn't take it and leave me. You know, that's how I thought. He left anyway, but fortunately for me, we're still married. Celebrated 17 years of marriage in September. Again, I would not have that if it wasn't for this program and being sober and working the program. I don't always do it well. The great thing that I have learned is that perfection is overrated, so it doesn't matter whether I work it perfect or not. The fact is that I work it. And the great thing about this program is I was able to find people that thought the way that I thought, that think the way that I think even to this day. My very first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous was at the noon meeting at the Alano Club. JC was one of the people that shared that day. And he drank like I drank. And I knew at that point that I was in the right place. I didn't know how much so until, you know, the fog clears. And it takes a little while. For me, I was very fortunate in the first few years of sobriety. I mean, things went really well for me really fast. I mean, I was able to repair my marriage. I was unemployed when I got sober. I got a job. You know, and you hear about that pink cloud. And I was 12-step by my dad. My dad, when I got sober, he had celebrated 21 years of sobriety the month before. And when I knew I was done, he was the person that I called. And he told me I could do three things. I could go into an inpatient program, outpatient program, I could go to a church to see if they could help me, or I could do what he did and go to AA. And a few hours later, I was in my first AA meeting. And the one thing that my dad shared with me, because I did, he was a sponsor to me, period. I mean, I had my sponsor. I had a few of them. I worked the steps. But he also sponsored me because we had shared so much. Our lives were entwined. All the pains that I had went through growing up were things that he had suffered as well. The loss of my sister when I was 5. The loss of my son. We shared these things. So I had a unique relationship with him. And he told me, you know, you're going to get knocked off that pink cloud. It's going to happen. But there isn't anything in this world that can stop you from getting right back onto that pink cloud at any time. It's your choice. All you have to do is work the steps. You know? And I've been knocked off a few times. More times than I'd like to relish, but, you know, I am an alcoholic. I have character defects. And yes, I give them to my higher power and then I turn around and I take them back. Because I'm an alcoholic. I don't think like normal people think. I'm not even sure what that means because I'm married to a normie. And believe me, he's not any... I don't know what the concept of normal is because he ain't it either. You know, he's got his own character defects and his own idiosyncrasies. And you know, so we try and figure those out together. And the one thing that I discovered in the program is that I was still doing angry well. Even after being sober for over 3 years, I was still doing angry well. And I almost lost my husband again because of it. In fact, we separated. We went to marriage counseling. We worked it out. But I realized that anger had destroyed just about everything, even in sobriety, everything that I wanted for myself, every joy that I had experienced in my life was tainted by the anger that I immersed myself in. And it was time to let it go. It was time. I had used it for so many years as a protection. You know, that was the way I protected myself against the world, because the world was a bad place for me. It took my son. It took my sister. It took. That's how I viewed it. Instead of looking at it the way that it is that it's life. People die. It isn't always a perfect scenario. I mean, not everybody lives to be 105 and die in their sleep. That's unrealistic. And it's perfection. And again, perfection is overrated. You know, I love the idiosyncrasies of life. I love the imperfections of myself that I still get to learn things. You know? Because God forbid I know everything and then think that I know everything. Because me and everybody else around me is in trouble. Seriously. Because if I know it all, who am I going to learn from? I mean, it'll be entertaining to watch on your guys' end. It'll be hell for me, though. And that's not what I want to do with my life. I want to live my life. That's what sobriety has given me, is the ability to live my life. It's not always perfect, and that's okay. It doesn't have to be. In fact, I don't want it to be, because otherwise I close myself off to the things that I can learn from the people around me, the people in the program, my child, my husband. I close all of that off. And then what's left? I know exactly where it'll take me, to another bottle. And I don't want that either. You know, I went to the academy, and a lot of people in the academy that I went with, they drank after, you know. And I just told them, you know what, you guys go have a good time. Here's my number. If you need a ride, I'd rather come and pick you up. I don't drink. I didn't have to explain myself. It wasn't necessary, and I don't. People that I work with, they know I don't drink. They don't need to know why. It's none of their business. You know? But if I have something to offer them, if I think sharing my story with somebody is going to help them in any way, I would make that choice. It's hard sometimes to separate work and home and sobriety in with what you do. There's boundaries, and sometimes it's hard to know when to cross those boundaries. And that's something that I've always struggled with, is boundaries. Boundaries, boundaries, and patience. I struggle with that still, you know. I'm not a patient person, never have been. Don't drive in a car with me, because I have no patience with other people's driving. One of my major character defects, still have it to this day. It's gotten better. It has. Thank you. You know, but life is fun. I love my life. I have a very, very good life. You know, like I said, it's not perfect, but I don't want it to be. I love the fact that sobriety gives me the opportunity to be of service in many, many different ways. And service is a big thing for me. I got into service pretty heavy from the get-go. And I haven't been in any service-related positions in a while, because what I discovered is that I was still relying on all that anger to keep me safe, and I was also hiding in AA because it was a lot easier to be with you guys than it was to deal with an unhappy husband or an angry child or to deal with a job that I detested at the time. It was just a lot easier to hide in AA with people that knew how I thought, knew, you know, and to be angry about it. Be angry about why my husband was angry with me or why my child wasn't doing this, or, you know, it's just a lot easier to hide. I just took one area where I was hiding in alcohol, and then put it in another area and decided to hide over here for a little while until that didn't work anymore. I learned a lot by that experience, though. I learned that it's not necessary for me to hide, and it's not necessary for me to be angry. Do I still get angry? Yes, I do. But I recognize it for what it is, and I don't use it as a protection anymore. And that's a big thing for me. Because protecting myself against the world was my primary goal for, I would say, well, I'm 48, so we'll go 43 years of the ones that I can remember. Protecting myself against everybody, you know, and everything. And I'm glad I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to be angry. I don't want to be angry. And I still revert to character defects, but it's progress, not perfection. There's a reason why Bill W. put that in there. Because, you know, we get to grow. Growing is key. Sharing with others is key. Being with the people that understand how your mind works when nobody else does is key. That's why the program works, is because we get to share with each other and somebody will identify with you. No matter who it is, where they are, you know, where they are in their, you know, whether they're sober, not sober. You know, we get to share ourselves, our innermost demons, and it's okay. You know, I can tell you the worst thing about me, and you're going to be there. You're not going to shun me. You're not going to turn from me in disgust or pity me. You know, none of those things happen. We're just there for each other. It's unconditional love. That's what we provide for each other. So that no matter what we've done, somebody else has done it. There's very rarely after what the program's been around for over 80 years now. So, I mean, there's no first-timers anymore. Somebody somewhere's done it. Or at least thought of it. You know? Our minds are a dangerous place to play, aren't they? But that's the great thing, is that identifying with... Where am I at? I can't see that. Is this a timer? No? I'm sure I'm over 10 minutes, though. So I guess it's time for me to sit down and open my ears and listen to the main speaker. Have a good night.
Oh. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a warm Tulare County welcome to our featured speaker all the way from Sacramento, Megan.
Okay. A little shorter. Perfect. Is that good? Okay.
Hi, I'm Megan. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Thanks for having me here tonight. Thank you, Sherry, so much for giving the welcome. That was beautiful and perfect. And thank you, Rick, so much for having us out to dinner earlier today. It was very nice, and I'm obviously a little nervous, so it helps with the nerves. Like you said, I'm Megan. I'm an alcoholic, and I was born in Visalia. We moved to Virginia and South Carolina, and then I moved back to Visalia in fifth grade. So I grew up here, went away to college in the Bay Area, but my parents, my mom, Ann, and my dad, Tom, who are both here tonight, they still live in Visalia, so come back quite frequently. My dad is in the program, so not a surprise here. I come from a house with a father who used to be an alcoholic. And my mom is a normie. I always think that if you looked up normal in the dictionary, there would be a picture of my mom. Just classic, totally could take or leave alcohol. Once everybody stopped drinking, she's like, oh, sure, fine, whatever. Totally weird. But my house, even though my dad was an alcoholic, and he got sober when I was in my mid-20s, so all through my childhood he was drinking in my early adulthood. And it wasn't that stereotypical. I think a lot of people had to deal with a more difficult household, perhaps, if their father was drinking. Definitely wasn't what you see in TV and film. It was a very stable household. Like, one of the core values in the Sullivan household is, like, stability. Like, we didn't like change. We didn't keep it normal. Like, nothing exciting. Because my dad didn't drink before 5 p.m. Hard rule in the house, right? And he only liked to drink at home, so he wasn't going out to bars, and my mom and dad are Irish Catholic traditional. They weren't getting divorced. They could hate each other. There was going to be tension in the house, but no divorce. My dad started a job at 18, and he retired from the same company, so I never worried about my dad losing his job or anything like that. And so my childhood was really, really good. I really can't complain. Around 12, 13, I was really close to my dad. Around 12, 13, he starts to get a little weird because I'm becoming a teenager, and that freaks him out. So it's really weird for me because I don't know what's wrong. Like, I think we're good, and he starts to pull away, and that's kind of hard for me. So junior high, a little like, and you already feel super awkward, right? And then, like, your dad's, like, not wanting to hang out with you, and you think there's got to be something wrong. What's going on? And then around 15, I started to just realize that's how my dad was, and, you know, it was okay. And I was in high school, started to feel a little bit more confident, and we started to have another great relationship. And but 5 o'clock was our time, right? So I always think of, like, the rolling credits of Oprah and the sound of vodka over ice, because it's 5 p.m. And Dad's come out of his room, and he's ready to re-engage. And I'm like, oh, sweet. So I make cheese and crackers, and I have my Diet Coke, and he has his martini. We talk about sports and politics and economics, and it's wonderful. And I loved it. And what I learned from that is what I thought. Alcohol brings people together. That's how you can engage. When you feel awkward and uncomfortable, a little alcohol helps, right? So when you go out and party and you feel a little awkward and uncomfortable, beer, you know? So that's good, and that takes me through high school. And all during high school, I have a learning disability. I'm dyslexic. And so I was diagnosed my freshman year of high school, but I was in all honors classes. So I'm like the really not smart kid in the really hard classes, and I'm just working really hard. That's what I did to try and compensate, because I'm a perfectionist and I want you to like me, and if I do everything right, maybe you will. And so that's how I went through high school. But I partied on the weekends because I wanted to be social and have fun and relax. And so that's how I made it through high school, and everything was good. I did well. I went in, got into Santa Clara, which is a university in the Bay Area. Go Broncos. And again, brand new set of insecurities pop up, because now I'm definitely not the smartest kid in the class. It's a super competitive college. I'm also definitely not well off compared to these other kids. I'm there on a lot of scholarships and grants, and it's an expensive school, right? So everybody else there has a lot more money than I do, and all the new insecurities come up. And what helps? Alcohol.
But you start to realize that your relationship with alcohol is a little bit different than everybody else. Like when you're getting ready in the dorms and the girls are changing their outfit for the third time and you're like, dude, the keg is like gonna be dust. Like we've got to go. You look great. Let's do this, right? And you're like, no other girl is like that. So I started to realize that it was a little different for me than for everybody else, or at least how I thought. I didn't see anybody who had that relationship with alcohol like I did, and I knew it wasn't normal. So I knew I had to hide it a little bit more, and so I just started to hide my drinking, you know, sneaking so people didn't see how much I was consuming. But I got through college, and it was fine, and I graduated. I moved to Sacramento, and I met my husband, who's here tonight, too. And we got engaged when I was 23. We got married when I was 24. He's 11 years older than me. I have two amazing stepkids who, when we got together, were 6 and 8. And now one's a senior in high school and the other one's a junior in college. So it's crazy. But the stepkids are really good and easy and sweet. And even his ex-wife is nice to me. Like, life's good, right? And I still want to drink, like, way more than everybody else. And I don't get why that's happening. I should be happy. And so I kind of look around my life and where could stress be? Well, stress can be at work. So I seem to pick employers who will create, who have stressful work environments. In fact, as time went on, I met this woman who ran a PR firm, and she was a control freak and crazy. And until a couple years sober, I realized I was such a willing participant in that relationship. I was like, you're going to tell me I'm crappy at everything I do? Sign me up. Because that means I can drink more. Because I'm legitimately stressed about you being crazy. And you display craziness, which my husband can see, so he does feel bad. And he's like, I get it, honey, you know, sure, whatever. He's not going to ride me for my drinking because we're so crazy. So about this same time, it's like, and I got sober August 5th, 2011, so I have 4 years of sobriety. This is about 07, and I've gained a lot of weight since our wedding, you know. So I'm feeling self-conscious, and I'm sitting at dinner with a girlfriend, and she's a normie, and so we're having a bottle of wine, and I'm drinking the bottle, and she got about a half a glass, and we're having our pizza, and we're bitching about how much we weigh, and we're like, we got to fix this, and she goes, well, what if we do Weight Watchers? And so I Google, like, you can drink on Weight Watchers. I'm like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. So we go to the first Weight Watcher meeting, and they give you this book, and it has all the points in there, and I'm like, oh, well, look at this, like, beer and wine and a shot and a half sugar of alcohol are all the same amount of points. That's 4 points. This is where I was going wrong. I've been drinking beer and wine. I need to drink hard alcohol, right? But about this time, it's about maybe a year prior, my drinking had increased. This is important. I started drinking not just in the evening. I started drinking at lunch with a girlfriend. You find the girlfriend who doesn't mind having a glass of wine at lunch. And then, you know, you start to, at night, you don't finish that glass of wine that's on your nightstand, so you wake up and you're like, I don't want to, you know, spill it on the way down the stairs. I'll just finish it right now. So, like, my drinking is progressing through all these justifications, but now I've got a really bad conflict because I'm trying to lose weight, so I can't drink the wine anymore, so I'm going to have to do, like, hard alcohol during the day, but I got to do what I got to do because I have to lose weight. So I start at lunch, and I maybe have, like, a shot at lunch, and that quickly progresses to a couple shots at lunch. And then, you know, the morning you're shaky, so maybe you're doing a couple shots in the morning. And by the way, I'm getting away with all of this because my husband works an hour and a half away from where we live. So by 6 a.m., he's out of the house. And by 8 p.m., he's home. But I've already had the opportunity to get home from work, pass out, wake back up, and he's none the wiser. On top of this, you know, you learn the tricks. You've got the bottles that you're shifting around. You've got the bottle that you're filling with the water. You know, he has a drink, and he's like, gosh, I guess my tolerance is high. You think you're poor SOB, you're drinking water. Like, you've got this whole system going, so nobody really knows what's going on. And it quickly gets worse and worse and worse to where I am absolutely every day have to have 3 shots, the big shots, a shot and a half, in the morning when I wake up, 3 at lunch, 3 when I get home from work, and I'm drinking wine throughout the day, sneaking out to my car and doing it. I have it in a thermos. And then I'm coming home at night, and I'm drinking again, and then I'm passing out, and then he comes back home, and I'm awake, and then, you know, I drink a little, and then we go to bed. So I've got the shakes, and I'm doing like the shots in the morning, and I quickly put my tongue under the faucet and I say the Hail Mary because I'm like, you have to stay in, because if you don't stay in, we're going to have the shakes all day. Like, it's not fun. You know, it's not the ads on TV where you're relaxing on the beach. It is complete and utter physical dependency. And about 09, about this time 09, we're supposed to go to a holiday party for my husband's work. And I'm nervous, and this is nothing new. Like, social situations scared me so bad because I have massive anxiety. I've been having panic attacks too, you know, I'm nervous about everything, but my body is slowly breaking down. And so he wants to go to this Christmas party. I do not want to go to this Christmas party, and I don't feel good. I keep telling him I don't feel good, and he's being sweet, but, you know, he's like, we're going. And all of a sudden, I get up and I go to the bathroom and I get sick everywhere, and it's black. And so we go to the emergency room, and they pump my stomach while you're awake. For those of you who have that experience, lots of fun, right? And I blow really high, and they're like, you know, she's got a serious problem. She has to stay overnight, so I stay overnight. And they run the tests, and I have a fatty liver. And the doctor I had wasn't super compassionate, and I get it. Not everybody's going to be, but he was like, here's your liver now. Here's your liver in 3 years. Here's your liver in 5 when you die. You need to get sober. And I'm like, oh my God, I had to like 50 or 60 before I had to figure this out. What the heck? You know, I'm not even 30 yet. Okay, I'm going to stop drinking till I'm 30. But, you know, in a month when I turn 30, I'm having a glass of champagne. Because you don't turn 30 without having a glass of champagne. So I convinced my husband, and he's just totally freaked out. Because he had no clue what my alcohol consumption is. He's like, baby, fine, yeah, glass of champagne when you're 30, fine, whatever. Like, let's fix this now, right? So, everybody's like, are you nervous about turning 30? And I'm like, I can't freaking wait, right? Because I'm having a glass of champagne. But I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, it'll be okay. I'll get through it. So we go to Pismo with my family, and I have my glass of champagne. But now I've learned how to drink moderately because I went a whole month without drinking. And a week, I'm right back to where I was, right? Like, what a joke. So I go through another couple months, and I'm drinking still. And now this is 2010. And one day, I distinctly remember it, because I would try to, like, ratchet it back. But for me, ratcheting back was still those 9 shots. It was just cutting back on the outside drink, the recreational, right, drinking of the wine, sneaking the wine and what have you. And I hear banjos, and I'm like, there must, my stepson in his room, the alarm must have gone off, the clock radio. And I go in, oh wait, no, the radio's not going. And I'm like, huh, that's so weird, but the TV downstairs. So downstairs, the banjo's not getting louder, not getting quieter. And I have Googled the heck out of like chronic alcoholism and everything, because it's not happening to me, but you know, I want to be knowledgeable of what it might look like if it were to ever happen when I turn 50. And I had distinctly seen that hallucinations were a big part of that. And I was like, I'm having an audio hallucination, and I was like, this is horrible, I need a drink. So nothing changed, but I was super freaked out. And then, like, shortly after that, the visual hallucination started. So you wake up in the middle of the night, and you think you see somebody in the side of the room. And you wake up, or you're awake another day, and, like, my husband came home from work, and I pulled him in the door, and I'm like, the neighbors have a gun, the neighbors have a gun. And he's so sweet, and he's like, oh, my God, you know. Nobody had a gun, you know, like, it just progressed for me. Crazy came on fast, let's put it that way. So finally, I admit to him, because on top of this, I'm having seizures. And I'm having seizures, like, at work. I'll, like, close the door, and I'll go have a seizure, and then I'll open the door back up. Or I start to have a seizure. I can feel them coming on. And so, like, I'd say to him, oh, I'm going to go upstairs real quick. And I go upstairs, and I close the closet door, and I have a seizure. And I feel better after them. And my dog had seizures, and we took him to the vet, and they said it was the brain rebooting. So I told myself, my brain just needs a reboot. Like, the seizure is good. Because I don't want to stop drinking. So finally, about January of 2011, I told Rob everything that was going on. And by the way, of course he's on to me, because post, like, my stomach getting pumped, like, there's fights all the time about the drinking and everything. But it's so hard for him, because I'm a functioning alcoholic. I have a job that's high pressure, that's 50 hours a week, but I'm still working. I'm still grocery shopping. I'm still doing the laundry. He still has no clue how much I'm drinking. And he's trying everything he can to love the alcoholic out of me, right? And it's never going to work. It's never going to work. And it's sad, but it's true. And so I finally admit to him that I'm hallucinating. And he knew about the seizures because I'd wake up sometimes in the middle of the night and he'd just hold me tight and I'd just seize. And he said to me, will you go get help? And I said, okay. So we go to the rehab center that Kaiser has. And they breathalyze me, and I blow a 3.32, right? And the doctor says, I don't know what concerns me more, that you blew so high or that you're talking to me like you just had like 2 or 3 glasses of wine. Like, you're really sick. And I'm like, oh, really? Because I'm feeling okay, and I still have this shot. No, you need help. We have to medically detox you. On lithium, and then you need to start our rehabilitation program, and it's 21 days, and you know, you come every day, it's like your job, and I'm like, I can't take a week off work. My boss will freak out, and you know, you want me to take the week off to detox, and then you want me to take 21 days for full-time, that's a month. I can't do that. And they said, okay, well, let us detox you, and then we also have a night program, 4 nights a week. You can do it after work, 5:30 to 7:30. I'm like, okay, that seems more reasonable. So I detox, and Kaiser gives us this letter to send to my employer so I can justify the week off. Accidentally, at the bottom of the letter, it says, detoxing due to acute alcoholism. That's confidential, right? But accidentally, it got sent to my employer. That, to me now, is God. At the time, didn't think so much, because it came back to work, and my employer knew. And I was a manager, and they stripped me of all my management responsibilities. And they have to provide reasonable accommodations, which means, like, we're going to make it super uncomfortable because you should really leave. You have a drinking problem. And my boss is, of course, livid because she's a control freak, and she prides herself on doing everything well. And she's just had an alcoholic work for her for the past 4 years right under her nose. How infuriating, right, for somebody who doesn't think they do anything wrong. So I go into the Kaiser program, I make it through phase one, which is 4 nights a week, like I said, and I relapse about week 3 of the program, because work is really stressful, and my boss knows, and I'm embarrassed. And but I keep going to the Kaiser program because I don't want anybody to know that I've relapsed. And so at my graduation night of phase one, I'm holding the counselor's hand. We're saying the serenity prayer, and my hand's shaking like crazy. And so afterwards, he pulls me aside, and he says, I know you relapsed, and I'm going to breathalyze you now. And I blew like a 0.02. So he couldn't, you know, he could let me leave that night. He couldn't keep me, but he said to me, if you want to come back, you have to do the 21-day program. You have to take that time off work. And I was like, I'm not doing it. And I went home to Rob, and I said, Kaiser's not going to work for me, but I'll keep going to AA meetings, and it'll be fine. And he's like, I think you should keep going on the Kaiser thing. You were doing great. And I'm like, no, it's too much. And work's so stressful. And he's like, okay. And then a month later, I'm right back to where I was, and I convinced him, and this is about March of 2011, that I need to quit my job because that's why I'm drinking too much. And he's so desperate, he says, sure, whatever's going to get you better. And so I quit my job, and now it's on, right, because I have nowhere to be. And all those promises of I'll volunteer and I'll find another job and I'll find temp work, they're all lies because I just want time to myself to drink. And he's gone all day for more than 12 hours, so I can get away with all this. And it just goes to hell because all I can do is, well, all I chose to do was drink. And I lay on the couch and I look up at this banister in our house and I just think, if I could just hang myself, if I could just have the courage to kill myself, this would end. But I was so convinced that I couldn't do anything right that I was convinced that the rope would break and I'd fall and I'd be a paraplegic. And then my husband and my family would have to deal with me because I knew I would screw that up too. And so I just lay there. And I couldn't really move because my legs trembled so bad that I couldn't walk. I couldn't get up and down the stairs. The thought of going to the mailbox was just like insane. Like you could have said, like, you know, let's go on a crazy excursion. And I'd be like, that seems about as reasonable as walking to the mailbox. Like I couldn't do anything. And I convinced Kaiser that I had social anxiety and that I needed anti-anxiety medicine because I had decided that that's probably what the real problem was. So they prescribed me Zoloft. So I'd never taken pills. Alcohol was love at first sight. There was never a pill or other drug situation for me, just not because I'm different. I just fell in love with alcohol. And but I have the same thought about pills as I do of alcohol. Like, if more shots help, then more pills will probably help too. So quickly, I don't even know. I'm not even going to try and lie and say, like, I knew I was taking that. I have no clue how many pills I was taking. I don't know how much I was drinking at the time, but it was way more than the stuff I remember, right? So the hallucinations are now through the roof. And my husband leaves to go to a business trip in the Midwest. And I am on the phone with my parents talking like normal, telling them how I'm not going to be in touch for a little while because I'm going to go do public relations for Michael Jackson's comeback tour. Michael Jackson's dead. And the dogs are taken care of. I've called the pet sitter. To this day, I don't know if I called Lynette. I could have called the pet sitter and set up an appointment. I mean, like, I don't remember it, but it was very feasible in my head. And my parents are freaking out, and my husband's freaking out, and he can't get a flight back home. And my sister, who I adore, she's Colleen, she's 6.5 years younger than me, and she is just the best. She drives up, because she knows her big sister is losing her mind. And she's calm and she's pragmatic, but she's not a bullshitter. And I knew that if I didn't listen to what my little sister said, I was in trouble. And there was no more drinking, and she called the cops. And the cops came, and they said she's a raging alcoholic, and she needs to go to the emergency room. And the next day, Paul drove me to the emergency room, and they said the same thing. She's an alcoholic, and she needs detox, and then she needs to go to rehab. And I said, I would totally do that, but we're going on a family vacation next week, so we're going to have to put this on. Because we're going to New York to see my extended family, and I'm taking my stepkids, and they've been looking forward to this, and this is going to have to wait. And so they're like, okay. And my husband's like, are you serious? And I'm like, I'll be so much better around my family, I promise. And he's like, okay. So we get on a plane and fly to New York. And the first couple days, I'm with my family, and we're at this beautiful family resort that everybody, that my aunt graciously treats the whole family to, and we love it, and it's such great memories, and I'm a hot mess, right? Like, my uncle, who's a cop, has to get involved one night because I drink too much. I don't even know what happened. I fell, and, like, everybody is like, what happened? And at this point, too, I'm super, super skinny because I can't eat anymore. Because, oh, the point system, like, you get points for eating, too. So I gave up food, and I was sticking with the alcohol. By the way, if anybody knows Weight Watchers, I far exceeded my allotted points for the day, you know, with just the basic alcohol I told you about. So it didn't really make sense. But I couldn't taste anything anymore anyway. Like, I had chicken, pork, steak, it all tasted the same. It kind of tasted hot and cold, but that was about it. So I was super, super skinny with a big old bloated face and a big distended belly, and everybody's like, what happened to Megan? And I'm shaking and I'm sweating and obviously those, and I just felt horrible after that night where I just made a total a-hole out of myself in front of my whole family who loves me. It's my mom's side and aunts and uncles that would lay down their life for you, and it was scary. And I remember the next day I was walking with my aunt, and my aunt Kathy is like the sweetest person in the whole world. Like, somebody's checking out at the grocery store and they have a cut. She's like all concerned. Are you going to be okay? Like, you know, she worries about everybody. And she was like, what's going on, Megan? And we sat down on a bench, and we still remember the bench, and I told her everything. And it was the first time ever that I didn't have a plan. I didn't say to her, like, and so I'm going to go to rehab after that. And I just said, I just want to die. And that's it. I can't stop drinking. I know I have to. If I don't, I'm going to die, and I don't know how to stop. And she just sat there, and she didn't try and wrap me in bubble wrap, which was classic Aunt Kathy MO, you know, or fix it or take me to the closest rehab center. She just listened to me. And we say that day there was 4 people on that bench. There was God. There was me and my Aunt Kathy, and then there was my pop-pop, my mom's dad, who passed away when I was in 5th grade because he was sort of the kind protector. And he let me open up in a way I never had, and he let my Aunt Kathy listen in a way she had never. And it changed my life. I didn't stop drinking, but I did know that I could say, I don't know how to fix that, this, and somebody listened. And I went on and I continued to drink. And after the family, we went away from my family, because the second part of the trip was to take the kids into New York City. And I went out to lunch and I got smashed. And I went home and I passed out and I woke up and I remember my stepdaughter, my stepkids, because I made amends to them. We talk about it, they don't remember my alcoholism, because I said I'm functioning and we had them like half time, so they didn't see us all the time, but they just remember I was always tired. I'm like, Megan, you're always sleeping on the couch, you know, now you have so much more energy. I was passed out, you know, but okay, fine. And I remember my stepdaughter looking at me, I still remember being on the street, and she said, could you just drink a little less? And that's the most she ever said to me, and it broke my freaking heart, because I couldn't drink a little less. I tried a billion times. And I went, and I passed out in the hotel, and I woke back up, and I went in the bathroom, and I remember seeing this little white washcloth sitting right there. And I picked up the washcloth, and I looked at myself in the mirror, and I said, if you don't fix this, your husband's going to leave, and he should. And that means you lose your stepkids, and that means you lose everything, because you got nothing left, girl. You don't have a job. You're not going to have anything. Tom and Ann aren't going to put up with this. They'll love you, but you're not pulling this at their house either. And I just looked at this washcloth, and I'm like, I think I deserve more than just you. And I was like, I got to get better. And we got on the plane to come home, and I said to Rob, I'll go to rehab when we get home. And I said, but I don't want to go to that Napa. Like, why are we going to wine country for rehab? And people see these ads, I'm like, I'm not spending all this money to go to Napa. And he's like, remember back when we had the first issue and Kaiser told you about the 21-day program? He's like, let's like start there. And I'm like, all right, fine. And he goes, you commit to me 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, we're going. Yes. 9 a.m. comes. I'm like, what about 11? He's like, 9 a.m. I pound a glass of wine. I get in the car. And that was August 5th, 2011. And I walked in there, and God sent me an angel of a nurse whose son had just a couple months sober, who was about my age, who had struggled off and on, and she could not have been kinder to the two of us. And she said what I was doing was incredibly brave. And I felt compassion. And I detoxed for 10 days on lithium at home and with my husband's close supervision. Those were fun days. And then I started the Kaiser rehab program. And like I said, 21 days. And the good thing about when I went into rehab, my brain was like straight up scrambled eggs because I had mush brain. And I had just gotten off lithium, so I was like totally. And like I remember sitting in between these two people, and one guy to one side was saying how when he gets out of here, he's going to become a drug and alcohol counselor. And another girl who's like, she couldn't wait to go home because she may have pill problem, but her husband had drinking problem. I thought, I'm trying to remember where the bathroom is in this facility. I was a wide open book. I didn't have a game plan. I literally came with a backpack because that's how I went to college and I learned stuff in college. So I thought, I guess you bring a backpack to rehab. So I brought a backpack. I took notes. I brought my lunch. I did everything you're supposed to do. They told me to get a sponsor. I was like, okay. I went to a meeting. This woman shared. I could relate to her story. I went up to her afterwards. I'm like, will you be my sponsor? She's still my sponsor today. Her name's Camille. She's amazing. Like, we talk about that time. She's like, I was mildly concerned. You had like a really bad twitch in your eye. I'm like, really? She's like, it's bad. But she was godsend. And she's so much like me, and she helped me, and she was kind, and she taught me that life is better sober. And rehab, Kaiser, really taught me, like, the health impacts. And I learned, because you're in there with people who have drug problems as well as alcohol. And it was a blessing for me, because I always kind of wonder, since I was sort of the well-rounded kind of gal, if I hadn't been exposed to so many people, women particularly, who finally got over their alcoholism only to become addicted to pills, if I would have not taken that aspect so seriously. And I did. I learned a lot from those women. At Kaiser, though, as well, for the 21 days, you also go to 7 AA meetings a week. And then after you get through that year-long program, then they step you down to 4 days a week in the evening that you're going to Kaiser, and you go to 4 meetings a week. And then for the final part of the year, you go to 1 Kaiser meeting, and then you go to 4 AA meetings. And that first year gave me a great foundation for learning how to live sober. I literally just learned how to live again. First year, didn't experience the pink cloud at all. It was the worst breakup because I loved alcohol and it was hard. Anybody who's in their first year here, I know you're going to want to kick me when I tell you it gets easier because I wanted to kick people when they told me it got easier. Thank God it did. But the first year was tough. Like, I would cry in the car, and I think people, like, could pull up beside me, and I'd have, like, Adele blasting, like, we could have had it all, and I'm, like, crying. And they're probably thinking, like, oh, her husband, and I'm, like, crying about Captain Morgan's. I'm, like, it could have been so good. Why did it go so bad? But it went really, really bad. And so the great thing is that it's for the best that we're no longer together. But I just, it was hard. And what I had done is I had become really rigid in my sobriety, too. I also took up distance running like it was nobody's business. Like, I'd say to Rob, like, I'm going to go on a run. And he'd be like, okay. And I'd run 10 miles. And then I'd come home, and he'd be like, really? And because I was just so angry, you know. Since 21, since I was able to drink, I hadn't dealt with a sober emotion. Like, I'm Irish Catholic. If things are good, you drink. If things are bad, you drink. If you're bored, you drink. Like, you know, and I'm not trying to say that as an excuse, but culturally we were raised that way. And I'm an alcoholic, so we're happy, we drink. We're sad, we drink. You know, like, that's just how I lived my life. And so now waking up to all these emotions was a little bit overwhelming sometimes. But I got, like, even little things, like learning, like, that Girl Scout cookies come out once a year. Like, that was brand new news to me. Like, at work, when everybody came around with the Girl Scout sign-up thing, and I was like, well, we can go to the grocery store later and get these, too. And they're like, they haven't sold Girl Scout cookies in the grocery store. I'm like, really? Sit down. Like, I hadn't engaged in life at all. But when I got sober, I was learning all these new things, and it was a lot. But God also blessed me with a job. Like, when I was in rehab, I interviewed for a job that I had heard about a year prior with an amazing newspaper in Sacramento. And I'd heard about it. A girlfriend told me maybe they were creating this marketing position, maybe they weren't. They created it, and I interviewed for it in rehab, and I got it, like, right out of rehab. Like, those people still don't know that I was in rehab when I interviewed. But it was an amazing job with a great support system, and it was such a blessing to be able to go from rehab right into that. But like I said, my first year was really, really tough. But once I got through that, and another thing is I fought the first year too. Like, I did come in wide open to sobriety, but I felt like if I admitted that sobriety was good, I was also admitting that I had wasted all those years drinking too much. And it's hard to say, like, I almost died for something that wasn't really that great. So nothing could be really that great, you know? And then you start to realize after that first year, you don't have to punish yourself and stay in this loop of things not being so great. You can actually just sort of enjoy life. And I started to really enjoy things. And it's through, I worked the steps that the first year, and I got through them after the first year. And it is, you learn so much about yourself. And you learn how to live a happier, easier way. And now in sobriety, I can say that I have a ton of hobbies. I remember I used to hate that question, like, what do you like to do? And I would always say wine tasting, because that was, like, socially acceptable. And then people are like, oh, and what else? And I'm like, oh, I do. Like, I don't know. I like spending time with my family. But now, like, if you ask me, what do I like to do? What day is it? Like, what's going on? What should we do? Like, your life just becomes so much bigger and so much more beautiful. And I have an amazing relationship with my husband now that I could have lost it, you know? And now we laugh and we do things and we go to the movies and I don't pass out. Like, and our dinner bills are way less now than they used to be. So we can go better places. And, like, things are just good. And, you know, like, you walk into an airport and you see all these people drinking in the bar. And I used to always think, because you have an 8 a.m. flight, and you used to look at them and you think, you could do this all the time, too, like I do. Like, you don't have to save this just for vacations. And now I walk in and I look at them in the bar, and I'm like, I'm not mad at them for what they're doing, but I think, I'm about to go on vacation. Why would I want to get drunk? That took a little while. That wasn't year one, like I said. But shortly after, you're kind of like, God, things are so good. And now at work, like, I just switched jobs in June, And it's so nice to sit in a meeting and maybe not get what's going on, but know you're sober, that you're not drunk. You don't get what's going on because you're brand new to a new job, not because you're totally lit and you're hoping nobody finds out. So all those little things. And as we all know, in sobriety, life isn't just a cakewalk. Like, there's hard times. You know, we faced job changes just this year. My grandma passed away in August. Like, since I become sober, I had a health scare. And those, I remember thinking when I had, they thought, potentially they found a lump and you get nervous. And I thought, I would have thought, oh good, a good reason to drink before. You know, now I have a real excuse. I've got all this stress. And instead you just think, God, life's just really getting good. Like, I know how to deal with change, but could we not deal with this kind of change? And then you get good news back, and you're happy, and you can celebrate by going out to a nice dinner that you remember, and holding your husband, and just giving thanks. And a lot of that is because of the spiritual connection that I was able to have with God. I'm lucky I didn't face the obstacle that I know a lot of people go through, where there's a real challenge there. For me, I was never particularly faithful. I didn't really, I grew up Catholic, but you just sort of went to church. I found God in sobriety because I was like, I don't know how to do this. Like, can you help? And there were times where God comes through. He just, for me, I felt like I could connect with that, and it put me at ease. Because there were times in the beginning that I remember lying on the kitchen floor crying because I wanted to drink so bad. And my little dog, my little Oreo, would come over and just lick my hand, and I'd say, okay, God, I get it. Like, I'll stay sober for Oreo. Like, I don't know. But, like, you know, we'll make it time by time. And I'm so glad I stuck around because life is incredibly beautiful. So I know I'm not going to fill up all this time, but that's about all I got. So thank you. Thank you for listening.